We're reading in the prophecy of Isaiah tonight, chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings, with twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another, and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphim unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. And he laid it upon my mouth, and said, Though this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I, send me. I want to link with that a passage in the first chapter of Ezekiel. Chapter 1 and verse 4. And I looked, that's Ezekiel looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire, enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the colour of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the colour of burning brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings, and on their four sides, and they four had their faces and their wings. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went every one straight forward. Now, look down, please, to verse 12. And they went every one straight forward. Where the Spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. Now, look further down, verse 15. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the colour of a beryl, and the four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. Now look at chapter 2 just for, maybe verse 26, perhaps is most important. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as the colour of amber, and so on. And verse 1 of chapter 2, and he said unto me, maybe I should have read the last verse of that previous chapter, verse 28. And as the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake, and he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. Now look at verse 5. This is for the people he's to speak to, and they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there hath been a prophet among them. That will do for reading. Now all perhaps know that, though some of you weren't here, but you will know that we were trying our best to speak during the week on the appearances of the Lord, to different individuals and the effect that that appearance had upon them. We dwelt a little on the wonderful interview that Abraham had. Then we went to Jacob and saw he had experiences with God. Then we moved over to Joshua and Moses and Joshua, and we saw that they had an experience with God. And then, of course, we went to Judges and dealt with the two notable cases there, Gideon and Manoah. And now tonight, we're going to take a look at two prophets that had an experience of God being manifested to them. Now, don't get all worried and bothered because we mentioned certain passages that you don't read often. And you get all frightened at them because you don't see the simplicity of them. And we try and make them as simple as we can before the meeting's over. The first thing that we want you to understand is this, that God revealed himself to men because of the difficult work that they had to undertake. Now, get that well before your mind. That is, it just wasn't to give the men an experience, nor was it even to reveal to them a great glory that he could manifest to them. But what he was chiefly doing was giving them such a knowledge of God, such a vision of the almightiness of God, and of the workings of God, and of the way God is served, that when they went to do service for him, they had the courage and the boldness to do it. Now, anybody knows who tries to do anything for God, that it's one thing that tests a man's courage more than anything else. You mightn't agree with that. But it's like going into battle, even taking a meeting. You say, surely after all the years that you've been preaching, it's just a simple thing. You just go and preach and you open your mouth and all runs out of it. Well, it just doesn't work like that. And all of you will know that if you live long enough. But there is heavy responsibilities. But you see, for two men to be given a ministry and be told when they were given it that the people to whom you're speaking won't respond. You needn't think you're going because of good results. Now that's a very solemn thing to do. To be sent to do a work that you would long to see done and yet it's not been successful. That's why these men needed to know that they were divinely sent and that it was God at work. And it was God's power that would accomplish all that he had in mind. Now this is a very weighty lesson for us all to learn. That when it comes, I think we've maybe rained at it unduly in these meetings, you'll bear with a repetition. But when it comes to the work of God, it's really what God does that really counts. And if he has purposes to fulfill, and may use a man to fulfill them, even though his work is not successful, it's still God's work. Men may look down upon it and despise it, but it's God's work. And these two prophets were especially instrumental in that way. Now, I didn't read in Daniel, I could have read in Daniel 10 and different other passages. You know, I could have found out a number of places where God revealed himself to different men. Maybe it should be helpful for you younger Christians to notice that there are two major prophets that had to do with Israel in the land. Now I know that Jeremiah maybe was brought down to Egypt, as you know, but mainly his prophecy was in the land. And so also was Isaiah. And then there are two prophets that God used for Israel whose ministry was outside the land. One was in Babylon, and the other was in by the river Kibar, possibly in the same country, but maybe 100 or 200 miles away from the city. Now, that's well interesting from that point of view. But maybe what some of you have not noticed, that the two men who prophesied in heathen lands, their name ends with E-L. And the two men who labored in the land, their name ends with I-A-L. I-A-H, rather. And it really is the same as J-L-H. It's Jah. It's Jehovah in abbreviation. Now you say, what are you getting at? Well, you see, when it's inside the land, the people in the land knew the Lord as Jehovah. When it was the heathen people, or people in a distant land, when they were speaking of God, they used the word God, or El, as you know, means God in Hebrew. Now, that is all very interesting to see. Then again, you will notice that these men didn't all prophesy at the same time. Isaiah would have been much the earlier. And then, of course, you know that Ezekiel and then Daniel would come in later on. And, of course, Jeremiah was right to the end of the captivity. Maybe I should say again, for the sake of some that don't read these things, that there were at least three major captivities. Daniel evidently was carried away at the first captivity, and Ezekiel in the second. And, of course, the remainder of Israel was carried, as you know, on the third occasion that the land was invaded. Now, all that was happening was amazing. Because, you see, you're changing over from the times of Israel to the times of the Gentiles. And Daniel, especially the instrument that showed the people that God was removing his name and his testimony from the power of Israel and allowing Gentile nations to assume authority and to have power and dominion and to control. And that has continued, as you know, until this very day, the times of the Gentiles, especially in Daniel. But you notice that when God is picking a man to tell us about the future kingdom of Israel, he selects a man who was a prince out of the royal line, that is the man Daniel. As you know, he is one of the princes in Israel. That is, God picked a man up who would value kingdom ideas. And when he's going to describe the future house and the temple and the religious side of things, he picks up Ezekiel because he was a priestly man. And the priestly man is given truth that he would appreciate, just as the kingly man is given truth that he would appreciate. And I hope you can follow that. That's not too deep. Sure it's not. That is to say, God chose instruments in keeping with the subject that he had in mind. Then again, I think you will also agree, won't you, that Daniel takes you into the millennial kingdom. He shows you the king set up and dominion given to him, but he takes you no further. He doesn't bring you into the millennium and show you how things are going on there. You have to go to Ezekiel for that. Oh, somebody, I never read those books. You can step away there, but I'm not going to worry my wee brain with reading these things. Well, you miss a lot if you don't. You see, they're all in your book, all as precious as Isaiah 53. You don't try to make out that they're of no value. God would want us to see, not only will there be a kingdom, but there'll be a time of wonderful rule, and his temple rebuilt, and all is functioning in accordance with his will in that coming day. Now you say, that's far from what you're at tonight. Well, we'll just get back to this now in a minute. We've gotten a sort of introduction. Well, here's a man, Isaiah. He's had an experience that he could never forget. He has been given a vision of the Lord, and he hasn't seen him down in a bush the way Moses saw him, nor he hasn't seen him in the way that Abraham saw him coming to his tent, but he has gotten a look at him in his majesty and glory, what we commonly call the pre-incarnate glory of Christ. That is what is referred to in the epistle to the Philippians. Yes, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. There's no doubt whatever that Isaiah got to see something of the wonder of the exaltation and glory of the Lord. That was most important. And then again, he not only saw that, but he saw how God was served by those created beings in his presence, those who covered their faces and who covered their feet and with twain they did fly. These instruments that God was using around his throne, and they were executors of his purpose and carrying out his will. Now they were doing it with a constant reminder to each other of the holiness of the God they serve. And they were reminding each other that there must be some swiftness about it. They flew. You see, there's a certain class of people that get you down, don't they? Now, maybe some of you men in the assemblies, you don't like to express your thoughts, and you like to let me to do it. And you know that's slow about doing anything. It would really weary you. You'd see them leafing over their Bible, maybe, and you'd think they're going to read you a verse, and they would put it over, and they'd put it over, and then maybe at the end they'd just close it up, and they'd just sit there. You'd nearly think that God's work was a something, yet you only did when you just had nothing else to do, a sort of lackadaisical sort of thing. God would have us not only to do his service, but do it in an alert way, and not to be sleepy at it, and not to be, as it were, dreaming of it. Surely, if you took a look at how he served in those heavenly scenes, I tell you, they would waken you up, and they would let you see that when they are called upon to move, they move, and they move quickly. And they act in absolute agreement with the throne above. Then, of course, it does remind us that if God is being served in the heavenly spheres, he's being served by a holy God. And they're crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory." That is to say, God's mighty majesty and glory is all over the whole earth, and he's in control of everything, even though it may look so different, as we'll see later on as we study these things. Now, a sight of that made Isaiah feel very humble, and it left him conscious of his defilement. "Oh," he says, "woe is me. I am undone." I think we all noticed every occasion practically that we had God revealed to a human being, his own corruption, his own nothingness, his own vileness seemed to rise up before his mind. He felt so unfit for the holy presence of God. Now, we do want to cultivate as best we can an understanding of the Lord and his holy character. The reason why, now you listen to this, the reason why Christians can trifle with sin and can do shoddy things that would make you feel ashamed that they ever named the name of Christ, and certain outbreaks would appear amongst us from time to time that humbles us all now. They humble us all, not just the individual involved, but the whole secret of it is they've lost the sense of God's nearness and God's holiness. See, a man in touch with God has a very keen, clear conscience about sin. He'll never look lightly on evil. A man in touch with God will see sin in its true character, and he won't trifle with it, and he won't play with it. Now, we know that we need to be constantly reminded of that, because you really live in a day, you know, when the worldlings that you work with and go to school with, and you play with and go about with, whatever way, if you're a little one, those people have no conscience about sin. And they can talk about sin as if it was just an ordinary thing, and do their utmost to justify almost all the corruptions that are upon the face of the earth. But to get a proper measurement of sin, we need to bring it into the presence of God. And you know that the prophet felt defiled and felt unclean. But you see, he was about to be commissioned. And if he was to be commissioned, he must be clean. For the Bible has made it clear that all who serve the Lord, be ye clean, ye that bear the vessels of the Lord. And whoever is going to serve God, whatever other quality they may have, or may not have, there's one thing essential and vital, that is that clean. And you know that the live coal from the altar, you've heard that preached in the gospel until I needn't hardly more than mention it. It's quite a familiar chapter. The live coal from the altar touching his lips. That is, he was linking the altar and the throne and the poor man Isaiah. There was a link there, wasn't there? The flew from the throne, flew to the altar, touched his lips. I know it's all figurative, but mind you, it's suggestive, isn't it? That wherever cleansing takes place, in some way or other, it's linked with the work of Christ on the cross. You know that. And you often quote the words, "The blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin." And you know right well that, well, the basis of all forgiveness, and all pardon, and all cleansing, must be the precious blood of Christ shed on the cross of Calvary, suggested by the altar and the live coal. Immediately that is over, God says to Isaiah, "Who will go for us? Who will go for us?" And he says, "Here am I. Send me." That is, he feels, having been cleansed. In fact, I would judge that when God was saying who, he in no way meant that anyone else was involved but the very prophet. And there's that willing response on the prophet's part to actually go and do the service that God has called him to do. He's been consecrated, as it were. He's been set apart. And he says, now, you're to go. And you're going to tell these people. And this is the bit that would knock the heart out of any preacher, wouldn't it? Now, come on, you all look to be successful preachers, don't you? My, you'd sing forever if you could preach every time you spoke and somebody got saved. And the whole place was all full of thanksgiving when you sat down. I tell you, you'd be all thrilled with that, wouldn't you? Now, he says, you'll go. And you're going to people that won't heed. And people that won't hear. And anything you say to them, they'll just take no heed to it. And they'll not respond the way they should. That was very discouraging, wasn't it? I wonder, have we ever learned? We'll never learn it likely. It's a very difficult thing to learn. I'll admit difficulties. I always have admitted them every night. I think I've admitted difficulties of some sort or other. It's very difficult for us to reconcile the lack of success and the will of God. Very difficult. We nearly always feel that, well, if it's successful, it must be right. That's why you get men and they make certain arrangements. And if they work, you know, man, let's say that was great. We got it all arranged. It went well. Couldn't go wrong, of course, because it was all fixed before it started. And they were all delighted with it. It could many a time be God's will to let us feel our nothingness that it doesn't go right. And it doesn't go well. Oh, you say, that's poor ministry. I don't believe it either, that, do you not? Sometimes the very failure helps to bring Christians to their senses. And helps them to realize there's something wrong. And helps them to confess their sin. And helps them to humble themselves before God. For if we were successful and still doing wrong, it would be no pleasure to the heart of God. He would want us to be right with himself. And to see that obedience to him is more important. It was more important for Isaiah to go and tell the people God's message than it was for that message to be fruitful in their response. Now, we can hardly measure it. I don't think there's anybody hardly here believes that. Slow to take that in, aren't we? That a thing that's not a success could still be of God. Hard to credit that, is it? Here he's actually told before he starts, you know, this thing's not going to work. You're not going to turn the people around. They're not all going to give up their sin and be what they should be and escape the judgment that's threatened. God foretold him of the problems and the discouragements that he would encounter in his service. But you see, he's serving God. And he's speaking the word from God's mouth. And he's accountable to God to give God's message. And when he has given it, he's not accountable for the outcome. He must leave that in God's hand. Keep in touch with God. If God is pleased to bless, to his name be the glory. If blessing is withheld, he can't interfere. It's God's voice, whatever way it goes, either in humbling his people or encouraging them, as the case may be. You say, well, now, you have trouble bringing us to Ezekiel, for you know we're nearly getting sleepy already. And what it'll be like if you get into Ezekiel, we'll get clean lost altogether. Now, don't get excited. I'll maybe surprise some of you, and I hope I am surprising you, for I want to do that. Ezekiel is far from the difficult book that people imagine it to be. You know why it's difficult? Because they don't read it. And, of course, they don't seem to value it. Now, that is very solemn. In fact, some men get up, you know, and they're very, I suppose, there's a bit of irony in it. They'll say, well, turn to the cleanest page, the cleanest book in your Bible. And, of course, they think that everybody will know where that clean book is. That's the book of Ezekiel, for nobody has troubled reading it. Now, I do admit, now, I'll be very humble, but when I finish, I hope you'll not think it so difficult. When I admit, when you read that first chapter, you say, dear, I couldn't make up much of that. This wheel is running here, and the swing's there, and the space is there. What kind of a carry-on is that? I can't understand that. And what reading that? Sure, that would put you around the bend. You just lay it down and say, well, now that's a hopeless thing, and I'm better let that alone. Now, that's not exactly correct, dear child of God. Because the thing is fairly obvious, what God is doing. And what he's doing in this very book is very simple in a sense, because he's teaching Ezekiel. Just before he sends him to bring his message to the people, he's teaching him his wonderful power and glory and his operations. Figures are used to describe that. Now look, when it comes to God operating, we couldn't understand his doings if he didn't use figures, because we don't know anything about the movements of the Almighty and his appearances and so on. Well, that would all confound us. So the prophet is led to see the glory of the Lord and the dominion of the Lord, and he sees it coming out of the north. He said, what's that new for me? Well, I judge it's very simple. Ezekiel lived at that time when a big part of the nation had been carried into captivity, and the remainder were about to be carried into the same captivity, and the whole judgments that had fallen upon Israel came from the north. Now you say, but sure, Babylon wasn't from the north. But no, to get into Palestine, they had to go round and over the Euphrates and come down through the Syria direction into Palestine. So that what he's telling him is this, that God is moving from the north, and he's moving in his purposes, and he's coming to deal with the nation of Israel, and he's coming to remove from them his majesty and glory. And the prophet will go on to describe how the glory will depart and will ascend, just as our blessed Lord ascended and went up to heaven, so the glory will depart from Israel. Then again, I think it's fairly simple when you take a look at the object that he saw. Now, don't be thinking that I'm oversimplifying it, but it looks fairly easy to me. He sees a man, and he emphasizes manhood, and he sees a man on the throne. And he sees a face of a man. Take a look at the word man in that chapter, and you'll see it's used quite often. You say, why not? Because God is working in an intelligent way, and his operations are all with an understanding of what he's doing. He's a responsible God in his actions. He knows all that he's doing is correct. Now you will see that there are four faces here. Now, they're not very hard to understand. I think anyone will see that it's the glory of God revealed in different faces. Now, there's an object here with four faces. You know it's not an ordinary thing. You needn't be trying to get an ordinary thing into your head. If you're a bit of an artist, please keep your brush in your box or wherever you keep it. For you might be making a fool of yourself in trying to draw this. So don't be pleased getting that into your head. But get a hold of the lessons, and that's all you need to learn. And you can leave the material object out of your mind. For instance, when God speaks, as I've said, of having a face of a man, that shows there's an intelligence. Man has something that the animal hasn't. Hey, listen to me. There's an understanding. So that when God is moving, as I said already, he's moving with absolute understanding. Then there's the face of a lion. That is, God is moving with power and might and majesty. That's not hard to understand. And then there's the face of an ox. Well, then God is moving with patience. With patience. Bearing with people. That is, not only has he the understanding of and all that is involved, and he has power and might and majesty like the lion, but he has the face of an ox, toiling, as it were, and patiently laboring to bring about recovery. Oh, how wonderful he was with Israel. How slow he was in his movements. He wasn't always crouching on them like a lion. He wasn't dashing in upon them with ferocity the way that creature would dash in upon his victims. No, while he had lion majesty and power and ferocity in the execution of his wrath, it was always mingled with patience and long-suffering with those who were there. And then, of course, it was the eagle as well, the face of an eagle. Well, anybody knows, like, if you're looking for the literal thing, it's hard to speak of an eagle's face, isn't it, now? If you're asked to draw a face of an eagle, you'd have trouble. So it's not a question of that, but this is the aspect, as it were, of God's dealings. And he's dealing dealing with eagle sight and with eagle swiftness. Oh, there's something lofty about God's doing. High above all,
And he has a full understanding. You see, this giving us an insight into God's way of working. Are you following that? Then you will notice, too, that not only have we this wonderful sight of these faces, but we have the wings. Also, somebody, don't get me worried. I can hardly take in what we have just said, and don't be troubling me with any more. But there are wings here, and their wings are pointing upward. That is, when there was activity, the wings were raised. And when this object, this cherubim, stopped, the wings dropped down. You see, when they weren't flying, they just dropped the wings. And they stood still. Oh, so somebody, what do you make of that? Well, I take it that God carrying out his purposes. Now, will you follow this? In his sovereign workings on the earth, he acts with, as it were, the flight of his wings in execution of what he has in mind. He can do it with swiftness, and he can do it with that heavenly character about him. And that is, there were wheels as well as wings. Now, says somebody, what's the difference between wings and wheels? Well, now, you wouldn't need to be a scholar to know the difference in that. You need wings to go up into the sky, and you need wheels to run on the earth. And so the simplicity of the thing comes out even more clear. That is, while the wings were sure God, in a heavenly sense, controlling everything from above, the wheels would show how they're moving down below. And those wheels were turning. Turning. Now what I want us all to say is this, that what was going on in the way with the wings was at the same time going on with the wheels. In other words, the wings and the wheels were working in perfect unison and perfect harmony. You see, now tell us, what do you mean by that? Well, it just means this, they say. God's wonderful plans that he has in heaven, and all that he is doing with heavenly wisdom, and with his swiftness and power in making changes in all these different ways. That's all organized, as it were, from above. But this is all carried out below. And just as sure as the wings were flying up above, well, says somebody, I can well understand God in control up there. I can understand that all right. Oh, that's no problem. But I can't see God under, I can't see how he's ruling with all that's going on in Northern Ireland, and all that's going on in South Africa, and all that's going on in Yugoslavia, and all that's going on even now in the States. All that. Is God, has he left it all? No, no. The wheels are running on earth, you say. And they're working in absolute unison with what's going on above. In other words, God's purposes and God's glory is continuing throughout the earth, just as it is continuing in heaven above. Now again, maybe you've noticed it. I think I read a bit of it just to catch your eye. But for half time, I don't take much heed to what I read, or even to what you sing, for people don't seem to think much in meetings. And I don't want to weary your mind on a Friday night, but I do want you to see, of course, if your mind's weary, what's mine? Of course, I'm a good bit older than some of you, so don't be taking any excuse. Now, what I do want you to see is this, that this passage makes it clear that they all go straight forward. Straight forward. Straight forward. That's repeated. You say, what do you mean by that? Oh, I mean very simply, that when God is carrying out his purposes, he doesn't turn to the right hand or to the left. And whatever movements he's making, they're straight ahead. He's not in any confusion. You know, whenever you don't know your way, you turn this road and you turn that road and you turn some other way, like the way I did the other night, you had time to get through here. But that bomb was on, I got lost in Lisbon. Just imagine getting lost around Lisbon. But I did get really lost. I didn't know hardly where I was going to land and where I was going to be because I was put off my track. But you see, God's not like that. Now get a hold of that. I'm using these things to make it. It's very simple. God has a course set. He has a whole program in view. And it's a straight line. And he's absolutely determined, and he's not going to be deviated from that straight pathway. It will go straight on, fulfilling every purpose and every plan in his heart. That's a wonderful thought, isn't it? Maybe some of you may not have noticed that when colors are being described in the Bible, quite often stones are used.
If you were in the book of Revelation, now some of you are in the book of Revelation, and you have been reading in the book of Revelation, and you read about stones and so on, and the color of this and the color of that. Why use stone for color, and not use some other means or something like that, and say the sky or this, that, or the other? No. What God has in mind is this, that colors in stone are fast colors. They don't change. You know, it used to be that ties weren't just as good as they are now. I think they're a bit better now, aren't they? You can wash your ties now and you can do things. It used to be you put some of the things in the water, the whole water was all purple or it was all blue, and the whole thing was all a mixture. Why the dye wasn't fast? But you see, stones don't fade with age. And their colour, even if they did get covered over with some, if you'd scrub them down and go back to the original, they'll still be the same colour. If it's a blue stone, it'll still be a blue one. If it's a red stone, it'll still be red. So these colours are what we would call fast colours, and they're described as stone colours. Then you'll notice that there were times when the wings weren't flying, and when the wheels weren't rolling on. Mind you, the wheels were high. Older, big, high things. Let us know that there's something majestic even about God's movements on earth. And they were full of eyes. They weren't moving without knowing where they were going. That was, that's illustrated in the picture that's used. But then there were times that the wings that were touching each other, no doubt reminding us, Ezekiel, who was a priest of the tabernacle and the cherubim inside on the ark and so on, the wings touching each other, and then they flapped out. There wasn't a move. There are times, you know, when there's not much movement, you may say, and things just become settled, as it were, for a while. And there's not the big activity on earth as there used to be, or as sometimes there is. Now, I know that God is always working in a sense. But you see, these cherubim, their wings could go down. And when they went down, there was no movement on earth. The wheels stopped. And there were pauses in it. Maybe you haven't noticed that very much in your Bible. What they would call parentheses, or breaks in the movement. Sometimes you'd turn over a chapter in your Bible and you'd maybe skip 40 years. And you'd hardly know what went on there. The wings had been down, as it were, and there was nothing big going on, nothing exciting going on. But then there were other times, you see, the wings were raised. Then the wheels would start to go, and the two would move straight forward, as the passage shows. Beyond that, he was shown another matter. And that is, he was shown a man on the throne. A man on the throne. Did you notice that? That is, he got to see a throne. But he's noticing that the throne is filled with a man. Now, I know I've been using the man from the intelligent point of view, and I think there's something of that in it. And whether here is just a sort of a preview of what there will be. For after all, now, when we have all this is all over, now listen to it very thoughtfully. This is vital. That the whole program of God on earth is going to be in hands of a man. That man who men nailed on the cross. The program of the future is in his hand. And he will be the one who will sit on the throne of his father David, as well as sit on his father's throne as he's doing just now. So there's a man connected with the throne. Now that is, we might say, almost the climax of what Ezekiel saw. And that really left him, flat on the ground. You know, if we can get a look at what God's doing, as God is doing it, it just leaves us helpless. Are you watching that? That is, with Isaiah getting the revelation of God, it made him feel like a leper. Made him feel his defilement. He was defiled. When Ezekiel gets a look at the great workings of the Almighty and of his glorious power and majesty. He just lays there. He lays there.
Now, the Lord speaks to him. He says, get up on your feet, man. I'm going to send you to that rebellious house. I'm going to let you carry tidings to those people. And you're going to be my messenger. Now, I hope you can see a parallel, without me pushing it, between Isaiah being sent in chapter 6 and Ezekiel being sent in chapter 2 of his prophecy. And I hope you can see that both men were fitted to go and carry out their mission because of the experience they had in the presence of God. I judge if we knew more of this, you see, it would make a big change on our public activities. They were in the presence of God, and they felt it, and they laid down. This man laid down on the dust. You know, John did the very same in the Isle of Patmos. And John had to be lifted on the Isle of Patmos. You know that the Lord came along and lifted him up. And you notice that he's just repeating what Daniel did in chapter 10 of his prophecy. Because he too was flattened and helpless and weakened. Because you see, every time a man takes a look at the majesty and greatness of God, he's bound to feel how puny and how helpless he is in what he would try to do. Oh, dear souls, it really gets me down a wee bit. Maybe you'll bear with me, for I'm not as honored as I should be. But when I hear men talking about, you know, I was able to lift so many in this district, and I was able to lift so many somewhere else, and I saw all that, those boys recently say, there's a whole family I got lifted. I lifted that family one time. I had a gospel effort, and that was what I was able to do. You know, it doesn't sound like me at all. I can't see that today. Oh, says somebody, did Peter not lift a big crowd of fish when he was preaching on Pentecost? I never heard him talk about it. Tell you, if you had him at the Easter meetings, he could give you some report. He could tell you what he was doing. He could give you someone to tickle your ears, couldn't he? Say, look, man, I saw more saved in a one meeting than the rest of them would save in a car. There are 100 legs that wouldn't see them all saved. Peter never went on with that sort of stuff. He was a wiser man than that now, and you see, poor Peter made many a mistake, and he blundered out things he maybe shouldn't have, but he never made that blunder. I hope you're careful, dear child of God, to know that it's what God is doing, and it's what God is accomplishing, and it's to God be the glory. Great things he has done. I hope we're conscious of that, because we need to be careful about the way we act. And not, as it were, step in and imagine that because we do see something done or God happens to use us, I happens to use us, that gives us something to clap us on the back, as it were, and that's a great applause for us, and that's a great thing to tell and boast about for the rest of our days. Now, these are very humiliating things. Come on now, we'll sit down for a minute beside Isaiah and say, now tell me, are you sure you're called? Now, are you sure that you're called? Oh, he says, I haven't a doubt about it. I offered to go when the Lord sent me. Well, mind you, Isaiah, you haven't made much of it. You haven't brought the nation back yet. And you haven't accomplished what you set out to do. The recovery and the averting of the common judgment. Well, I can't say anything about it. God told me that's what would happen before I started, so I'm not disappointed. And I'm not surprised. And I'm just prepared to do it, as God would have me do it, and leave the issues with him. Leave the outcome with the Almighty. And again, supposing you had sat down beside Ezekiel, I said, I'm sure you're very fruitful. Man, you had a great start, hadn't you? You remember the visions you got by the riverside? And you remember the wonderful revelation of the glory of the Lord that you saw? Oh, Ezekiel, I'm sure your preaching went well home. I'm sure it didn't fall flat. No, he says, the trouble with it is. Aye, the trouble with it is that they just didn't heed. They wouldn't heed me. They didn't listen. They wouldn't respond. Nevertheless, I had no doubt whatever. I was as God would have me be. Now, I should mention another thing, because I don't want to miss this. I'd love, you know what I'd like as a result of this meeting? I would like that I would start you all reading and meditating on the book of Ezekiel. You see how easy it is when you take a look at it. It's so easy, you'd wonder you didn't be at it long ago. Sure, it's just as simple, as obvious as it can be. And you don't need to get puzzled and worried about it. You can have a look at it and have a read at it. But I'll tell you what you can't fail to see. Now, you can't fail to see that though he was a divinely sent instrument, and there's not a question or doubt about that, it was a costly life he had to live. He knew what it was to lie on his side now. And whatever length you take that, literally or well, that was every night he slept on his side or whatever way you understand that. It was no pleasant. And mind to tell you, he wasn't laying in a nice divan bed or whatever you call those things. He wasn't down in that, and he wasn't in a mattress this depth. I tell you, it was just the hard road. And mind, it was tight going. And he was eating all that difficult bread. And maybe worse than all, now, I think this is better. It's in the day when he had to bury his wife in the middle of his service. And God took the very partner from his sight and let him feel the pangs of having lost. But you see, Israel, as God's wife, you see, now you listen carefully, had turned away from him, and God felt the loss of the nation and their faithfulness, and he would have his servant enter into it in his own bitter, painful experience. Now, will you remember that? But you know, God's a great God of compensation. Isn't it? And if you sat down beside Ezekiel, he could tell you a painful death, couldn't he now? Be honest about it. He wouldn't need to have to make up a story to tell it. He just needed to just recall the past. And the sorrows that he passed through in his labours for the Lord. But you see, God compensated him. And he gave him what no other man has been given. A wonderful future outlook of the nation of Israel in their kingdom glory. When he would actually see the very house of God, the plan of it, and the whole idea of it, and that coming city of Jerusalem, and the prince in his place, and the Levites in their place, and the priests in their places, and the different things that was revealed to him. And the wonderful resurrection of the nation under the figure of bones, been brought together, and the return, he listened to it, for it's not easy to take it in. He had painfully watched the glory departing as it went up from Jerusalem, saw the glory of God disappearing, and the nation left without it. And then he had the great joy of seeing the same glory return to the house, and return to the city, and saw the Lord entering the future temple through the east gate. And he had the joy of seeing recovered what he wasn't able to see in his day. You follow what I mean? What he wasn't able to bring about by his prophetic ministry, what he wasn't able to accomplish with his own toil and labor, he got a vision. It's coming, all right. Oh, we love it, don't we? God's purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, and it had a bitter taste with him. But sweet would be the flower. And he got a look at the wonderful glory that lay before. And he got a look at the wonderful recovery of the nation. Don't you see? Wasn't it a great thing? Now, be honest about it, that he had this experience with God at the start. For that was how he was equipped for his trying experience later on. And at the same time, sufficiently humble, so that when those mighty revelations were given to him, they never inflated him. They never caused him to rise above anything else. He was still a humble servant of the Lord, a prophet with his own people. Oh, how much there is to be learned even from the very painful experiences of some of these choicest servants of God. Yes, it was a wonderful thing for him to be acquainted. And you know, later on, he can say, "Not I just that was the same glory as I saw by the river Kibar." He saw that same glory. Like, he never forgot that. And he had an insight into things, and maybe you haven't noticed it, like, but he has a wonderful insight into truth that's, in a spiritual sense, enjoyed now. Because, you see, he is he who has the sprinkling of clean water and so on, and the new heart and the new life. And he has a wonderful insight into shepherd work and all the recovery that will be granted along that line. And so there's a wealth of truth in that wonderful book. A wonderful mind. I've often said to myself, you know,
that I suppose if you were only asked to keep one book in the Bible and say that you couldn't have any of the rest, possibly Isaiah would cover more ground than any of the rest, and we'd get a great deal of teaching in the prophecy of Isaiah. I would say approximately, now just approximately, the half of Isaiah's prophecies are known, or little known. One half of it's well known. There's a whole big section in Isaiah that nobody got.
You never heard it read in a meeting. I mean, you'd be looking up at me as if I'm telling something that was strange. Nobody reads it publicly. Never mentioned.
Said,
and that's just as important as the bits that they read. Oh, you get Isaiah 53 read, and 55, and 42, and 43, and you get all those chapters read. But mind you, there are big stretches of Isaiah.
And I've been a wee while amongst the Lord's people, and I never hear anybody mention you think it weren't written at all.
You think it weren't in the Bible? They're nearly like the book of Ezekiel. They're left alone.
Surely God has something more in His Word. I wonder, are we missing it? Are we losing treasures that we never notice because we don't look at them? Are we failing to go into God's treasure house and explore the wealth that's available? Or are we just feeling, well, you know, beyond me, I'll leave that to the preachers, and if they can't manage it, sure there's no use for me praying, and I just let it go. I hope the Lord gives us a wee bit of courage. A wee bit of courage. But when He uses figures, He means us to look at the figures that He used. And Ezekiel mustn't have been too much annoyed about the figures that He used. And too much upset, for it didn't seem to annoy Him a bit, only it made Him feel He was so helpless in the presence of such majesty and glory. Now, how does that, shall we pray? Our Father, we trust our meditations in Thy Word will be really blessed. Oh, we long and we pray that Thou wilt unfold to us more and more of Thy precious truth. How sweet it is. How valuable it is. How it thrills our hearts to see that Thou canst tell the end from the beginning and tell it with such accuracy and with such detail, so that we can rejoice even before events take place. We thank Thee for every child of God in the company whose eye has been fixed on future glory and who has been able to rise above the mere trifles of earth and the passing scenes below and has been allowed to enter into something of that which is going to be our portion in the presence of Thy Son forever. O God, it won't be long, our journey here, Our broken sigh and falling tear will soon all be over, and we'll be at home with Thyself in glory, seeing the full fruits of Calvary, seeing the joys that fill Thine heart as Thou dost look upon the sea of faces, praising Thy name throughout all eternity, giving Thy Son His rightful place in heaven. And what pleasure it will bring to Thee to look down upon the face of a cursed earth and see the change that redemption will work down below, and the many on the face of the earth who will be enjoying Thee in their hearts and who will be acting in Thy fear on the scenes below. Comfort us, Lord, as we make our way home. Shield us from every harm and ill, we beseech of Thee, and bless Thy word to all our hearts. O God, increase our interest in it is our cry before Thee, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.